Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. One thing I've learned is we must stay positive. We must look at big problems facing us not from the lens of insurmountable, but instead seek a series of small wins and milestones that are moving us towards achieving bigger and broader goals. One way of doing this is to turning to individuals that are already leading the way as inspiration, folks already drafting and refining approaches that can be tested, proven, and replicated, basically by turning to agents of change. Most of the conversations we've had in Sourcing Matters have been around these change agents focused on food and agriculture. But whether focused on terrestrial production or fisheries, soil vitality or ocean health, each of our episodes that we've hosted, there are a certain level of expertise that are dedicated and underpinned by core competencies like systems thinking, proper natural resource management, and even things like being part of a natural order instead of trying to forcibly control it. Food is an interesting conversation starter for the environment and our role and place on the planet. Food is intimate to us all, yet we've lost sight of the impact that food has on our own health, on our communities, and of our planet. Einstein said, "The environment is everything that is not me." Food is what connects both our well-being and the environment. And despite the current landscape, food and the environment can't continue to be political. We must tweak the narrative. Running our tanks dry and kicking the can down the road will help no one on either side. We must embrace the reality that we have a shared planet of finite resources in dire need of balance. The crux of this is much of the partisan divide, and it actually can be our greatest opportunity for all moving forward. It's like this, conservation of natural resources, proper management of regenerative natural resources themselves, and preventative healthcare for those in need is a pragmatic business approach, as we'll all find moving forward. And to get us over the hump, let's not forget, it was Nixon who started the EPA. It was even some of the current old guard right now on the right, like past Speaker of the House and now talking head Newt Gingrich, who began his career in Georgia as a hard-charging environmentalist. But these have been stressed. We've seen over the last 18 months in this administration, we've pulled out of the Paris climate agreements. And we've seen countless egregious acts of hubris and corruption that past top dog, environmental top dog Scott Pruitt has put us in. We've witnessed the president who seems to believe that nature comes only with 18 holes. And all of this, while easing restrictions for individuals and businesses to dump more greenhouse gases into the air, toxins into the soils and streams, and plastics into the oceans. Can't we unify around this? Thomas Jefferson famously said, "In the environment, every victory is temporary and every defeat is permanent." So no matter how we got here, we're here. And we need to deal with it. That fuse does seem to be getting shorter. So what we've learned is that we do have leaders from all over with diverse backgrounds ready for their time at bat. This has combined with a citizen's awakening of what seems to be a zeitgeist of Generation Next, where responsible action can be the permanency that we need moving forward and not the permanency of recent defeats from this administration. Maybe it's a gut check, maybe a call to action for us to gain some small wins together for greater good and stability. Our guest today has her hand squarely affixed to the bat, and spikes dug in. She has a track record for small ball wins and moonshot home runs. Her background in fighting for an evolving practice and policy relating to the environment is second to none. Today, we welcome a change agent of positivity, Gina McCarthy, the director of Sea Change at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health. Hey, Gina.
Hey, Aaron. It's great to be here. Is that really true about Newt Gingrich?
It is. It is. Isn't that crazy? I was doing a little research.
Who knew? Man.
I was surprised to see that myself, especially when you hear him now. You know, it seems like every cycle comes about, he's ready to get up there and talk about how bad the left is and what the right's doing right, no matter what context, right?
And well, they say consistency is a hobgoblin of small minds. So I guess you and I have to live with our small minds and try to live consistently with certain values. Others may not find themselves so limited, I guess.
That's right. That's right. And I apologize for the baseball analogy, but I know you're a big Sox fan. And when the Sox are on pace to win 112, I had to throw that in.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? I was at the game last night, and they're going to be terrific as long as I stop going to baseball games. Because every time I go, they tend to get creamed. So this is just aggravating.
It is. I know. I'm maybe I'm not superstitious, but I'm a little stitious. So I believe the same way.
Little stitious.
That's
that
right.
Very cute.
So, Gene, let me give a quick introduction, if I could, for you, and then I'll jump into some questions.
Yeah.
So Gina McCarthy has been a leading advocate for common sense strategies to protect public health and the environment for more than 30 years. She served under President Barack Obama as the 13th administrator of the EPA from 2013 to 2017. Her tenure as EPA administrator heralded a paradigm shift in national environmental policy, expressing links within global public health. Prior, during her career in Massachusetts, McCarthy advised five governors on environmental affairs, worked on state and local levels on critical environmental issues, and help coordinate policies on economic growth, energy, transportation, and the environment. You have an unbelievable past in what you've done now, and I'm very excited to talk about what you're doing now with the Sea Change School at the Chan School of Public Health. So could you share with our audience what you're up to at the Center of Climate, Health, and Global Environment?
I can, Aaron, and thanks for the opportunity to do this, because I think your introduction was really terrific, because we can get really discouraged about what's going on in Washington, D.C. today, and we have every reason to be discouraged. But the most important thing that we can do is to really realize that the future is in our hands. And we have to grab opportunities where they come, and we need to be positive about it, and we need to speak in ways that people will get excited rather than discouraged. And we just have to keep moving forward. And as you noted, the environmental world hasn't been owned by either Republicans or Democrats. You know, I worked for actually six governors, five of which were Republicans and one was a Democrat. And we made progress moving forward. And I think we can keep doing that, because in the environmental world, you know, the closer you are to the ground, the more you see and the more you generate grassroots organization and activity that tends to push its way up, so that when the grassroots level speaks, things happen. You know, things don't just start at the federal level. They sort of work their way up so that grassroots organizations grab issues. They get obnoxious enough that states tend to go, oh, whoa, we better do something. And states get obnoxious enough that the nation changes. So we can't be discouraged that when Washington, D.C. falls asleep, we have to move ourselves. That's how it's always happened. And one of the reasons why I'm at Harvard is because when I left Washington, I knew we were heading for a bumpy road. That was very clear based on what this administration came in by their own statements, came in to accomplish, which is to basically try to roll back everything that was accomplished in the Obama administration and to look at a future by going backwards, to looking at generating more interest, excitement in coal and other industry sectors that really have been waning for decades. So the challenge that I faced was, what do I do now? You know, and I ended up doing a couple of fellowships at Harvard. I found the students to be incredibly exciting and engaging. They had a sense of social justice and equity that was just palpable. And they just did not want to tolerate moving forward in a world that doesn't recognize that science is real, that climate change is happening, that man-made emissions are causing it, and that we have to do something, not least of which is to get women into office so that we can get these men out of the way. That's a joke for you, Aaron.
But I take it to
heart. There's some truth to it.
Absolutely.
But the issue really is that they gave me hope and excitement, and I wanted to continue with that, because You know, when I was at EPA, I was trying to explain to people that EPA, and forgive me, I love birds and bunnies, but it's not a birds and bunnies agency. It really is a public health agency. So I wanted to sort of continue with that hope and enthusiasm, hanging out with those students. And I had this wonderful opportunity that I was given to work with world-class scientists that have really saved millions of lives by explaining the connection between environmental pollution like air pollution and public health, helping to articulate what that damage is and make it come alive for human beings and generate a lot of the progress we've made over the past few decades and you know, start working with them. And the whole goal of our new Sea Change Center is really to make sure that science is driving actions continuously, that we're not disputing facts, but we're getting facts out to people in ways that they can digest them. The dean wanted the science to be done not just well at the school, but to be communicated well, to actually get into the hands of decision makers so that we can make a difference based on real facts on the ground. And to me today, with the issues of climate change and health as looming large as they are today, that I think by addressing climate change, we can actually open up the greatest opportunity we have to improve health in this century and perhaps any other. So I refuse to say that, oh, woe is me, climate change is horrible. I want to say that climate change is opening up our eyes to what we need to do to live sustainably. And a low-carbon future is something we should be running towards, investing in, talking about, getting excited about. And I want people to know that climate change is perhaps the most direct threat they have to their health today and their future for the kids tomorrow. But taking action against climate change is perhaps not just the answer to it, but the greatest opportunity we have to chart a future that is sustainable. So it's so much fun, as you can tell from the tone of my voice, that I feel like I'm using the same skill sets that I have used for decades in the public sector to translate science, to get to decision makers, to get to people not just in government, but in the business community, in the nonprofit sectors, in mayors that matter, in governors that care. Let's just get around and aside and under or over this partisan politics that's holding us back. And let's talk about health today and a bright future tomorrow. That's what Sea Change is all about.
That's fantastic. And I couldn't agree more. This is a new cost basis for the future economies, right? We have to get on board or we'll be so far behind in global economies that in a four-year period with this administration, could we catch up? Could we move forward? It seems we have the infrastructure, and it also seems you're investing in this infrastructure by developing a new school. And obviously a very prestigious university like Harvard has access to the right individuals. So how have you gone about, or what is the plan for going about of bringing in those multi-stakeholder initiatives, those multi-dimensions within the business community, within academia, within public and policymakers, to bring them together and to define that common language so that they get this is a great opportunity. Yes, we have to do it, but this is a tremendous opportunity for future economies.
Well, you know, we're doing it in a variety of ways, and one way is that we're really focused on putting science to work. So there's great things that we are learning about health challenges and solutions, and we can translate that science to make information that is being identified more understandable and relevant to the public as well as decision makers. We can hold public forums and convene key decision makers to inform them of public health risks and how to reduce them. And we can educate the scientists of the future and how they can leave not just being great researchers, but communicating it, you know, getting out into your community. Everything is about reaching people where they are, not bringing them up to the levels of any ivory tower or any school. And so we're all about bringing together community leaders, talking to the public, bringing together government entities, people in the private sector, so that we're bringing the science there. And we're doing it in four different ways. One of the places that's most mature in the center is our work on healthy buildings. You know, what we've identified is that, you know, you and I, maybe we hang out outside more than many people, but the vast majority of people spend 90% of their time indoors. And so we worry about what the outdoor air quality is, and we forget that as we make houses and buildings tighter and more energy efficient, we're also encapsulating that building without giving complete thought to what is that indoor air quality that we're all spending the vast majority of our time breathing. And we have a wonderful program that takes a look at how healthy buildings are important, how you actually not just construct them, but how you monitor them, how you actually look at performance as it relates to healthy buildings, and what does that mean for a changing climate? Because recently we had the same group that put out a research paper on heat stress and what it means for students who are in buildings that one group had air conditioning, the other group had tremendous heat stress from not having a good ventilation system or an air conditioning system. And it showed that there were tremendous differences in cognitive response. They had an inability to think clearly and quickly. And so there's ways in which we can begin to address this, not just with air conditioning, but with trees and with shading buildings, thinking about indoor air quality. Another area is just working with cities on climate issues. You know, if you're a mayor, and you've made a commitment to Paris, which thankfully, as President Trump sort of took us out of announcing we're out of Paris, we see hundreds of mayors, dozens of governors, and literally more than 1,000 businesses stepping up and setting goals consistent with Paris so that we could explain to the international community that we are still in. But mayors need help. They need help to figure out how they address the climate challenges that they're facing today in ways they can afford. One way they can do that is to look at normal infrastructure and start factoring climate into those discussions. For example, if you have money that maybe an EPA got you from a Volkswagen settlement to actually give billions of dollars out to states to invest in electric infrastructure for vehicles and reduce diesel emissions that Volkswagen caused by illegal activity, you can use that money to buy electric buses. So where do you put those electric buses? Your best advantage from both a climate perspective and a public health perspective is to run them in communities that need it the most, where the air quality is not good, where you have low income and minority populations that are most vulnerable to air pollution and most vulnerable to the challenges of climate moving forward. So we want to work with mayors. We want to work with individual businesses. We're collaborating with the Harvard Business School to reach businesses because they can make a difference. They can speak to products, what's healthy and what isn't, and they can drive new products, better food, healthier food into the system. If people know about it, reward the good guys and call out the folks that are lagging behind. So there's ways in which we can really connect the dots here, especially when it comes to healthy kids and climate. That's one of our biggest initiatives, is really people need to understand that climate isn't about polar bears. It's about their kids. It's about their health. It's about their future. And your future, your kids' future and their health today is being impacted by climate in a number of different ways. And there are ways in which we can address those issues together. But we need people to understand it. We need them to get the science, understand it. We need to bring them together. We need to inform them. And we need to let the science do its job. Because I love people. If they get good information, they are going to take action on that. And that's what Sea Change is all about. So we're working on healthy kids and climate, healthy buildings, healthy cities and climate, and food and nutrition as one of the central components of our strategy moving forward.
Let me ask this.
Makes sense.
Of course. I mean, it's a systems thinking approach that I align with 100%. Many of our listeners listening in will align with many of our past guests. Absolutely. And it's exciting to see someone of your background that's taking the lead step here and moving this forward. But let me ask this, because I'm going to take us back. And I agree. I get very positive of this, and I think how encouraging it is. I see the grand opportunities. Not only do we have to do it, but it is an opportunity for future economies based on this. But how do we get to a point, Gina, where with all of this consensus from global scientists, from the narratives and the stories, from the stories, what's happening in Salinas Valley with all the respiratory issues because of the use of neurotoxins and hormone disruptors and all the chemicals from pesticides, from all of these stories, how do we still have climate change deniers? Is it just a case where we've got corrupt executives and leaders that are living in a falsehood to protect their interest in business as usual, and they have enough of a platform to define this narrative? Or am I missing something?
Well, you know, Aaron, I think that's the $10 million question. Huh? I should sort of add about three or four zeros to that. You know, I think that clearly there was an early on concerted effort to try to confuse the issue, much in the same way as you saw the tobacco industry try to confuse the question as to whether, you know, tobacco smoke caused cancer. So there was clearly some companies felt that they had a vested interest. In this case, the fossil fuel companies had a vested interest in maintaining our country and every country's reliance on fossil fuel. But I think it goes well. The challenge goes well beyond that. Listen, Aaron, people react to things they can taste and see and smell. You know what I mean? Something visible. And climate change is difficult. I think we've failed miserably at communicating the science in the way that people understand that it's about them and their family, as opposed to just we're worried about some people who live on the seacoast or in developing nations where they might have populations that are at risk, and instead recognizing that it's all about our health and our children's future. And so I think the communication's been difficult. The science has been hard to explain. It's not right in front of people's faces. And so I think the challenge for us is that it's been caught up in now partisan politics, as if, you know, Republicans don't need a healthy earth. You know, that just can't be the case. We cannot allow it to become part of a party platform to either deny climate science or to push for climate action. We just have to get it out of that venue. And I don't think anymore it's so much about the money as much as it's about the communication. Because, you know, President Obama had a great saying when I worked for him, and I'm sure he continues to use it now. And he used to call climate not just an environmental issue, but a public health issue, a national security challenge, an economic concern and threat, but also an economic opportunity. And that is because today we have solutions on the table that we can define as being not just opportunities to reduce greenhouse gases that fuel climate change, but that make our world healthier today, that make it brighter, that create jobs of the future, not turn us back to jobs that are waning. And he used to make a very clear statement the country that makes its path forward quickest to clean energy is going to be the strongest economy in the world. That's what we're seeding here if we don't take advantage of this. And lastly, he used to say that, and I don't need to put him in past tense because he's still hanging around, but one of the favorite sayings that I had was that he used to say that this generation is the first generation to feel the impacts of climate change and the last generation to be able to do something about it. So I am less discouraged than you might be about people's inherent understanding that the world has changed. They see the wildfires that are devastating us here in the United States. They see the equality challenges that remain here in the United States and really, most importantly, internationally, that's taking between 7 and 9 million lives prematurely every year. They see the fact that we have Zika virus here. We have contagious diseases springing up that we thought we left behind ages ago. We have challenges with how we grow agriculture and feed our healthy food to our children in a way that will reduce food insecurity and protect the health of our planet. They see these things now. They see the drought. So we are not denying, I don't think, and can anymore, that the climate has changed. So we have two choices. We can argue forever about whether it's man-made emissions until we have no ability to reverse the issues, the climate challenge that we are facing today and in the future. Or we can recognize that a healthy future is within our grasp and think about climate change through a health lens so the argument is negated at its very start. If I can show you that everything you would do to invest in climate change and build a healthy planet is exactly what you would want to do to improve the health of your family and your children today, we will make those things happen. We just have to be positive about it, make those connections, and frankly, stop Washington from simply making it part of a partisan platform when it has nothing to do with whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Absolutely nothing. If you're a human being, you got to care about this and you got to act.
Gene, if you could see me right now, I'm pumping my fist in the studio in 100% agreement. You a kindred spirit. I couldn't agree more. I get all heated up and excited about this as well. It's just as many people say, this is the greatest things facing humanity. How we address these problems now is the essential steps forward that will cast the future for our kids and grandkids. And it does require that positivity and perspective and to gain that the facts, but really just the narratives that help define that. But one of the,
and I think if Aaron, just one last point for me is that if people can stop thinking that climate change is a distant threat, or if we can stop pitching climate change solely as something scary that we would need to avoid, and instead, talk about the ways in which we can improve our lives together based on technologies that are available, that are cheaper than the kind of technologies we have been using to fuel our economy, that will grow jobs of the future, then I think, it's a strategy of stop scaring people and start creating the Pied Piper thing. Mm-hmm. Play great music and let people follow you. I've been doing this for so long that those solutions weren't available to us in the early days. So it was understandable why we were trying to, put a really big rallying cry around the need for action. But today, it's really just the need for us to be open to opportunity, the need for us to take advantage of what is right in front of our nose. And don't let anybody tell you that in the United States, we have to accept anything less. We never have. We've used science to drive our decisions, our actions. That's what's brought innovation, excitement, new job growth, growth in our economy while we address our pollution. Just because you can't see it now, climate change is real, and we've just got to grab those solutions and convince people to run with them as fast as they can.
So let's talk about Scott Pruitt. I got to do it. I got to ask.
That brings it right down.
I got to bring it back. I'm gonna put the brakes on, and just because I'm with you. Yep. But I think some of our audience will want to know what this is, because first of all, if you sue an institution more than a dozen times, there has to be some mandate that says you can't run that. I think that has to be written in the law somewhere. But aside from that, he followed you, right? All the great work you've done, everything has been there, all of this global effort, these initiatives you talk about, and you get a guy like this that takes this. Explain to us, because I think this will help our listening audience, because I throw my hands up and think, oh my goodness, how can this happen? And thank goodness he's out. This is the devil reincarnated, but thank goodness he's out. But we'll have ripple effects from he, or whether it's Andrew Wheeler that's going to be doing things. Whoever this administration puts in there, it's going to be a challenge. But how did you dust yourself off? How did you put a positive perspective on that? Or maybe it's a situation where, hey, look, if we keep toiling along the way that normally the things were moving for the next 15, 20 years, nothing is going to get done. Maybe the Band-Aid need to be ripped off for us to even take these steps like you're speaking of, like we're talking about on this podcast, to really move us in the direction we needed. So that's a bit of the game theory. But please, if you'd share with us where we're at with that.
Well, you know, first of all, I guess there's a whole bunch of different ways to answer that. You know, I did dust myself off and try to stand up tall. And I do that every morning because I really have to do it every morning because the news is difficult. And not just about Scott Pruitt, but a number of ways in which I feel like this country is not embracing the values that brought us all together. And so I can't help but worry about it, but I have to put it in perspective. And the few things that I keep reminding myself to Scott Pruitt is that it's not just me that was appalled by his behavior, but it was, you know, Republican administrators that had the job before me have stood up and really criticized Scott Pruitt because he didn't embrace the mission of the agency. You can come in and win an election, and if you win an election, you deserve to establish your own policies and convince the folks in the United States that your policies are going to bring us forward. They did not do that. They just simply attacked the science. They just simply took information and tried to get it out of the public venue so people couldn't make decisions. They came in with their own wish list that they had already come in terms of where they wanted to land, not how they can pay attention and learn and do the science and follow the law. But what allowed me to stand up every day was the fact that I knew when during the Obama administration that we followed the science. We paid attention to the law. We did extraordinary outreach. We developed fact-based records. And in order for this administration to roll all of those back, they had to do another rule to roll it back and rules to replace it. And that they were not in a position to be able to pay attention to the law and science. They had to dismiss it. And that if they continued with this, I have this end game, I'm not going to pay attention to the science, I'm not going to pay attention to the law. I'm going to write shorty rules. I'm going to just cut the process, the public process out, that they would lose in court. We live in a checks and balances government. I had to rely on the court system. And early on, they made these movements to stop the rules, stop enforcing. They were taken to court, and they got their hat handed to them because that's not how we do business. And so I feel really good and confident because we did it right. We worked with folks to make our rules reasonable, to make sure they were cost effective, not overstretching our economy, but actually continued to take advantage of public health benefits as well as economic benefits of moving to a cleaner future. And so I'm confident that they couldn't roll it back. And so that's why, When I got to Harvard, I think the major thing I needed to convince students, and I think we need to convince the public, that if we're confident that the rules were right, then let them play out in court. But we have to recognize that if the federal government is not going to enforce things and not going to move forward, then it's up to us to stand up. And that we can't get discouraged by that. It's our opportunity to keep moving forward. Because if you remember, during the Obama administration, we got a lot of things done. But prior to President Obama coming into office, the federal government had never taken one step forward or one action on climate change. Nothing. So it can't be that nothing continues to happen. We can lead at the grassroots level. We can lead at the city, our community level. We can lead at the state level and the regional level. We can be doing the grunt work to get everybody continued to be involved. And then when this administration steps aside, we will be fully prepared to actually re-engage at the national level and take our place in the international community. And that's what we have to strive for. So we can fight the changes in D.C., but we can also advance our own interests in our own backyards and in our homes. That's the best we can do. And vote, by the way, Aaron.
Absolutely.
Vote for people that share your core values and your interests.
Yeah.
That's where it's going to matter.
Yeah, and I kudos to you, Gina. That's great insight, and thank you for that. That's wonderful inspiration. And I'll just add that when this administration maybe not steps aside, maybe swept under the rug, when we reverse all of this anti-laws that we put in and look at this as maybe the steroid era equivalent or something of the hiccups,
yeah.
Then we'll move forward. But, you know, we were joking here actually at the recording studio that maybe we could actually pick up Pruitt's $45,000 soundproof booth here at the recording studio on Craigslist for pretty cheap at this point too. So,
well, you know,
amazing,
the hope
amazing.
Is that you could fit a couple of select people into that booth and shut it so that you have you don't have to listen to them as well. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, it works both ways. But yeah, it's, you know, one of the reasons, Aaron, if you think about it, is they've spent so much time trying to stop people from listening to real facts that, you know, there is a power there in real information. So what you're doing with your podcast matters.
Hmm.
You know, reaching out to people and what we're trying to do at Sea Change matters, because we have to get facts out, information to people. You know, in the 60s, we used to say information is power. Guess what? It still is.
No.
So let's just keep working it. Let's not get discouraged. Let's keep moving forward as best we can and support one another.
Yeah.
And then invest in the change in Washington that we need to see.
Let me ask this, if I could, for a piece of advice. So
yeah.
I've heard that zealots die a painful death, and I've learned, myself being a zealot that maybe has been transformed, maybe looking at things differently, is if you're a zealot, you can be a bit boring. So when I would talk about all the perils of food and planet, I'd come in and say, oh, I'm the worst person at dinner. I know all the truths. But I think that led people to say, oh, boy, here comes Aaron. More lectures. This is just what
yeah.
I need, right? Boring,
yeah.
boring, boring. So we have many, many folks in our listening audience that are tip of the spear, that are really moving something along here, whether it's food or ag or environment. So what's your advice to them? You know so many truths. You've been through all these. You've drafted some of these policies. You know, so many things have evolved. How do you keep this in check? How do you not let it define you and let yourself be a person, a well-rounded person, that your impact is felt across the board?
Well, you know, I think that the most important message that I would give to people is, you know, when you're dealing with systemic change, you know, human beings hate change. You know, they only vote for people that say, I want to change. I'm going to change the world. Only when they get there, they're hoping they actually won't change anything. Because people just don't react to change well. And so you got to recognize that we're all in this for the long haul. And the most important thing to do is to listen. You know, the ways in which a person, you know, that has a career like mine, which is in public policy and serving people, is you've got to understand that people come to the table with their own perspectives, with their own interests, with their own concerns. If you start off with the solution that you've defined, then you will never, ever succeed, because you really do just have to listen. You have to understand what's important to people, how they perceive things. And there are many ways in which you can articulate the direction that you think the world should go in a way that allows them to see it as of value to them. that reassures them that the things they care about are being considered and thoughtfully integrated into any solution. I think we all just kind of want to shortcut that process. And in doing so, you create a barrier between yourself and the very people you're trying to convince. So listen. Start off with questions. Even if you have what you think is the right answer, your best strategy is to make the person you're talking to come to that conclusion without you having to find it. Then you will have a collaboration, not a one-way street.
It's the classic Carnegie book, right? How to Make Friends and Influence People. Be empathetic and understand where they're coming from to let them see the insight and the truth. So,
I suppose, but I think really it's a little bit more than that because I don't think you're really trying to sell them anything.
Yeah.
I think what you're trying to do is connect from one human being to another about things that matter to both.
Huh.
And so I think that's part of the problem. It certainly with this administration is. They didn't want to listen to anybody other than they had already listened to. And as a result, we have a country that's more divisive than ever. And somehow, we need to talk to one another again.
Great advice. Well, Gina McCarthy, thank you so much for taking the time to joining us in today's episode. Where can our listeners learn more about Sea Change? Is the easiest place online to search for Harvard Chan School of Public
That's
Health?
That's correct. At the Harvard Chan School of Public Health, and it is called Sea Change. You can find us on, you can find us on Facebook.
Mm.
If you want to look at facebook.com/HarvardSeaChange. We're on Twitter. We're on LinkedIn, so you can find us everywhere.
All right, I'll put some links in the write up. And I knew you were on a speaking tour for a while. Are you still doing speaking engagements in coming months when we come back from vacation?
Actually, I am. I'm doing a lot of things. One of the things we're most prepping for right now is to have quite a bit of presence at the Climate Change Summit in California in September. That Governor Brown and and Bloomberg are sponsoring. It's going to be an opportunity for us because we're going to be one of the only sessions that focus on health. You know, I still think people are focused a little bit too much on how much greenhouse gas reductions you get without, you know, explaining that health is the bottom line. So we're going to do our best to make that case and bring information to the table. So that's where I'm going to be focused quite a bit in September. But I give a lot of speeches, mostly to other universities and college students, because I just don't want them to get discouraged or upset, you know, or angry. I want them, you know, to make sure that they stay hopeful because they are one heck of a bunch of human beings. And I hate to see them thinking that the United States isn't the country that we were brought up in, and that will be again. And so I want them to get active, not angry.
It is an opportunity for us to step up and dust ourselves off and be the folks that we should be. So and I think I couldn't agree more. The idea that climate change and the impact on public health. And materializing that to ourselves, to our families. And we do that often in the food side of things. That's quite a silver bullet for connecting some of those natures that I said in the beginning. It really is that connection to the environment. It is an actual act of eating the environment to keep your body healthy. So what an opportunity to bring this full circle and make this a systems discussion. So,
but Aaron, we have reasons to be hopeful. Really, we're marching again and demonstrating. How cool is that? You know,
it's very cool.
I put my bell bottoms away a long time ago. I'm going to pull out my Madras outfits and my tie-dye things and keep going out because you got the science march, you got the women's march, you got Black Lives Matter, you got the students from Parkman. You know, people are coming alive. Let's embrace that.
Yeah. I think you've just put together your outfit for that September conference in California.
That would make news.
That would make news. That would be.
Especially since for some reason they've all shrunk. It couldn't be me, but it is definitely those clubs.
That's right. All right. So whether we're instigating change from our dinner plate or in a lab and research center or via technology innovation or from some of the prestigious institutions and most prestigious institutions in the land, we have the talent. We just now need to mobilize around small victories and successful milestones from the grassroots. And as Gina said, let's get out and vote. Let's find the folks that align with our perspective and see this as an opportunity of the future. So, Gina, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share such incredible insight, to share what you're up to, and to provide inspiration for so many of us in looking forward.
Aaron, thank you so much for all the work you're doing. It's terrific.
Well, thank you.